Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey guys, you ever wonder what Phil and I wear while we podcast? You can find out if you join our Patreon. We'll also be talking about the films of 1989, but that's definitely less important than seeing our Zoom backgrounds, our headphone choices, and our sweatshirts.
It's true. It's true. You'll get to see all the various pieces of artwork that I have framed on my office wall, and you can see Kenny's garden, sort of. So that's something. That's exciting.
It's a hanging garden.
It's a hanging garden. But perhaps more important than anything, we are doing this Patreon to cover the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, with amazing guests like Tom Meissen, Liz Hanna, Joanna Robinson, Brian Cogman, Chuck Hayward. You can sign up at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. And for $5, you'll get access to all the audio of these fantastic episodes. For a few bucks more, you'll get video as well of our 99 and 89 episodes. And perhaps, most importantly, you'll be supporting us so we can just keep making podcast content for you guys.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 from the set of Double Bind here in 2021. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phil Iscove.
And with us today is the writer and executive producer of Harley Quinn. How about that? Patrick Schumacher, nice to have you.
Thanks for having me, guys. Glad to be here.
Yeah, we're real glad to have
you. We're thrilled.
Here.
We're thrilled.
Felt real good saying that one. It's better than it's. I don't even want to say.
Yeah, I was gonna say you're gonna throw someone under the bus.
No. It's better than my wife. Who we've had.
Wow. I guess you're it's safe she's not going to listen to this one.
I'm banking on her passing
on Perfect Blue.
But she may not. You want to know what? Her favorite movie is Parasite and her favorite movie of the year is Minari. So she does have a thing for Asian and Asian inspired cinema. Yeah. Which is a perfect segue into Perfect Blue.
Indeed. Indeed.
How you doing, Patrick? And why did you pick this wild movie to join us with on the podcast?
Well, first off, I'm doing great. Good. Thank you for asking.
I respect that you said that because I'm so tired of the performative misery
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You
know. See, like for some reason, I think right now, as things actually seem to be getting better, people still feel the need to ask how you're doing with, well, horrible. There's a pandemic and my life is small. No. If you're doing great, you're doing great. I think people want to hear that.
Yeah. Even in non-pandemic times, like judging by that, I'm doing pretty great.
Good.
So yeah, everything's coming up Patrick Schumacher right now.
Good.
Why did I pick Perfect Blue? Well, you sent me a list, and I'll be honest, it was a lot of leftovers.
welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999.
Welcome to year four.
Right? This is definitely a season four, year four kind of movie. This is a deep cut. I also liked that it was an animated film, because that's kind of what I've been immersed in, the world in which I've been immersed the last, like 3 years, 4 years even, with Harley Quinn. And it's one that I saw like all the way back in like 99 when it originally came out, and it stuck with me. We'll get into the gory details, but it's just a fantastic film from a guy who, Satoshi Kon, who is unfortunately no longer with us. But you know, his body of work is small, but extremely influential. So last year, there's this award show called the Annie Awards, which, Harley Quinn was nominated for one of them last year. And I got to go, this was an in-person thing, and they hold it over at UCLA, and Satoshi Kon got the Winsor McKay Award, which is Cecil B. DeMille, like the lifetime achievement, or like if you, contributed a certain, outstanding body of work that kind of, I don't know. Moved the medium forward. I don't really know anything about the Winsor McKay Award.
No, you nailed it. There's no question.
No, it's an convinced award. Me. There
if
you
it's
go.
Real. If it's not that, then what is it? I mean, of course, that's what the award's for. Yeah.
But it's for like animation legends, right? Like the same year, Henry Selick got it, and Musker and Clements, the guys who directed Aladdin, Little Mermaid. Yeah. Basically, they give this award out to anyone. No, but they give this award out like to multiple people. It's a very long ceremony, even longer than the Oscars, if you can believe it.
Really?
But Satoshi Kon got it posthumously, and just watching the reel like reminded me that his body of work, albeit like four films or whatever it is, four or five films, hugely influential. So here we are.
Can I ask? I know that you are currently immersed in the world of animation. Do you know anime? Like, is anime a big influence on you? Do you find yourself like, I am, whenever I watch an anime film, I find them just absolutely like mind blowing. And I think to myself, I need to watch more of this stuff. And then unfortunately I don't, because there's a million things to watch. But this film, and you can see its influence, but I'm just wondering how sort of anime influenced your work on Harley Quinn.
Oh, the actual work on Harley Quinn, I would say pretty minimally, because I would say of all of the staff,
like sure.
I might know it the best, maybe me or one other person. My producing writing partner, Justin, he's maybe seen Akira, like maybe.
sure. Maybe some Miyazaki, no?
I turned him on to Miyazaki, and he showed his kids Kiki's Delivery Service and Ponyo. And he's like, my kids love Ponyo. So he's familiar.
Okay.
He's familiar. Okay. But when I was a kid, you remember Suncoast Video, right? So that was like the only place you could go to get like ridiculously overpriced VHS copies of like Pat Labor or like Dominion Tank Police. And I was just buying them for the covers, as I still do for like CDs and shit. I'm like, oh, this is gorgeous. I don't care what the music sounds like. that's how you're supposed to buy albums.
Yeah, yeah. Judge it by its cover. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
So anyways, that was kind of how I became indoctrinated into anime initially, but I kind of fell off over the years, and now I'm more into like the classics, like your Akira's and whatnot. Sure. So,
but critically, you do know what you're talking about, because Phil and I don't. And this podcast will fall apart Like it will just come apart at the seams if Bill and I just go back and forth saying, you know, it's a lot like Black Swan. Hey, remember Black Swan?
Sure.
So it is a lot like Black Swan.
What do you know about Perfect Blue and Satoshi Kon, and it's Cone, right? Satoshi Kon. At least in the one YouTube video I watched about it, they pronounced the Cone.
That's possible.
And
they got it wrong at the Annie's.
maybe like Mr. Meatball or whatever his name is who put this together got it wrong too. I'm not sure.
But
Phil, did you watch the video? It was pretty good.
I didn't watch the video, but I know what you're talking about.
But you do understand its place in anime history, and I think the one thing that struck me watching it, aside from all the you know, the visuals and the story and all that stuff we're gonna get into, is if you're an American or a Canadian, if you're a person working in North American film and television and you want to tell stories like this, it's nearly impossible to find someone who will buy adult animation and then allow you to have these kind of themes and these kind of visuals. Yep. And I think now maybe I'm showing up, you know, kind of What's the service called? Crispy Roll or
yeah, yeah. Crunchy Roll.
So Crunchy Roll notwithstanding.
Yep.
I think you're kind of the closest in this country to having a mainstream animated show with adult themes, and you still are a comedy. Yes. You know, you still are kind of comedy forward. So that annoyed the shit out of me. As a writer, sure. Particularly one who's out with an adult animated show right now, but the shit out of me as a writer because it feels like a door that we have not opened in this country. And the only guy
who tried it was Ralph Bashke, I believe is how you say his name, back in the 80s. The guy who did Heavy Metal, and he tried to do Cool World, which obviously, you know, in the shadow of Roger Rabbit was a pretty colossal failure.
Yeah, Lord of the Rings,
exactly. So, like, he's the only guy who tried, and he tried at a time when it might have been easier. I'm not even really sure. I mean, obviously, you know more about this than I do, but, is that the only other guy that comes to mind?
You'd think with 400... shows or 800 shows in a good year, people would take this kind of chance more often.
I think it's going to happen now just by virtue of the whole pandemic. It's driven people to animation because you can do it remotely, right? So I think we're going to see kind of a glut like next year or in 2 years, because it does take a while to do to actually produce scripted animation or non-scripted. Documentary animation is very hard. It takes a really long time.
Rotoscope the whole thing.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
But you're going to see more of it. I mean, in our case, we just got lucky because we had Warner Brothers Television. A different person was running it at the time, Susan Rovner, who's now over at NBC Universal. And she called us up, Justin Halpern and myself, and was like, hey, are you guys interested in doing an R-rated animated Harley Quinn thing at the time with Margot Robbie attached to it. And we were like, well, yeah, I mean, she's just come off of, we were like, absolutely not. Hung up on it. spit in our face with this offer.
Yeah. The human anchor? Come on.
So yeah, exactly. So, and you know, she was just coming off of like the success of Suicide Squad, and she was kind of like the breakout character in it. And then I think also, with Deadpool kind of being in the zeitgeist, they were like experimenting with like, you know, doing R-rated comedies and R-rated animated stuff because Deadpool at the time also was like in development at FX or was just about to be, I think, like before that Donald Glover was involved with.
Right. I think that script kind of went around.
Yeah.
I feel like I read it. Yeah.
Yeah, and we thought we got put on hold. Actually, this is 2016. This is how long it takes stuff. It was 2016 when they originally asked us to do it. Long story short, we had to shelve it for a year because they asked us to run the show Powerless for NBC, which was also set in the DC universe. Anyway, so I remember Powerless. Yeah, so we had to shut. That's and so like Ron Funches and Alan Tudyk, who are voices on Harley, were actors in series regulars in Powerless. But anyways, we had to shelve it. And then Deadpool became a thing, and we were like, oh my God, like Deadpool is going to beat us to the punch. It's going to be terrible. And then everybody's going to think we copied it because we've been there before. We had a show on the air called Surviving Jack that everybody thought ripped off the Goldbergs, even though we like did our pilots at the exact same time, but whatever.
Right,
Goldbergs were the fall show. We were in mid-season, whatever.
You're not bitter. You're not bitter
very at all. Different. This is for the Patreon, right?
Yeah.
And then Deadpool like just completely dissolved. So we did a very happy dance at the time, and then got to poke fun of that a little bit in our promos that aired in like 2019, but at New York Comic Con or whatever. It legitimately just like fell in our lap. So it wasn't something that we were like pursuing at all, because especially Warner Brothers, like they are very sort of, it's two different fiefdoms, Warner Brothers Television, Warner Brothers Animation. And only now are they starting to kind of intertwine a little bit. And HBO Max, of course, that its existence has sort of paved the way for more adult animated stuff. So we're taking out another pitch as well.
I hope that you guys are at the tip of the spear, because to Kendi's point, it does feel like it's really, you know, it's rich terrain. And I don't know why it's taken as long as it has. And, you know, watching this film, which actually came out in 97 in overseas.
Yeah.
So it takes, you know, the better part of a year and a half to 2 years to get here. And quite frankly, I mean, I'll give a little bit of context in a second, but like, doesn't exactly set the world on fire over here, doesn't make a ton of money. It obviously has a big following now. It is a staple of sort of anime when you talk about that genre of films, that sort of the cream of the crop. This is definitely of that tier. But it's taken years and years for it to sort of build that kind of acclaim. So it is kind of interesting that it's taken as long as it has for us to get at least a couple television shows. Thankfully, your show being your show also has the freedom of being baked with inside a well-known group of characters too, to some degree, right? So you guys have a little bit of, you know, so that has to be fun too, that you get to be able to kind of play inside a sandbox that other people have preconceived notions about. I think that must be a lot of fun too.
Absolutely. And I think this was partially it was a function of DC kind of loosening the reins, right?
Right.
But also I think it was because, so when we were going to take the show out, the idea was like, oh, we're going to take it to Netflix, or we're going to take it to, you know, Amazon or whatever. Amazon had already like preemptively like called Warner Brothers, like, we'll take it. And then this DC Universe thing, which doesn't exist quite in the same way.
Right.
That it's been kind of gobbled up, right?
By HBO
Max. Yeah. Kind of, yeah. Like it now exists as like a comic book only thing. Because like the unique sort of selling proposition or whatever of DC Universe was that it's got like a bunch of like DC library TV shows, movies and whatnot. But it also has all of these digital
it's
comics.
Everything ever, right?
Everything it has like everything that's like a year prior to its release and before, right?
Oh,
so it has like 30,000 comics or whatever on it, which was pretty cool and set it apart from other services. But because it was this fledgling thing that they were doing, they were like, well, we'll pick you guys up for essentially two seasons of 26 episodes. And we were like, okay, well, yeah, then we'll pitch you guys like two discrete seasons of 13. And when I say two discrete seasons of 13, I mean, we're going to pitch you one season and then we're going to say that there is another one that we're thinking about.
Sure.
Like, oh, okay.
But it'll be on DC Universe, right? Okay.
Yeah,
but you'll sell it to us though.
Is Harley in it? Yep. She's still in it. Oh, great.
Great. Great.
We'll take it. We'll do it.
Oh my God.
But
who
because
put
of that,
Kite Man in it? Who is the genius who put Kite Man in it?
Well, it was like credit to the staff. You know, we were looking
for that guy's dope.
Yeah. I mean, I give most credit to Tom King, who was writing Batman at the time and kind of revitalized Kite Man and gave him like an actual, like really dark backstory where he had this, like, he had a son who he caught essentially saying hell yeah. He chastised him for cursing, right? Mm-hmm. His son. And that was his son's, that was his last interaction with his son before the Joker killed him and his son.
Uh-huh.
So like hell yeah is like a tribute to his dead son. So it's fucking dark. And And we put that in the show. Yeah. And we actually had a nod to it where, I mean, Kite Man started out, he was like a complete douchebag and he was trying to screw Ivy and like totally exploited his dead son to try and you know, exploit her sympathies. And then so we had that in there and then we were like, oh God, no, we cannot keep this. And
people are really precious about Kite Man. You know what the Kite Man stands after you.
Just today somebody tweeted at me, they're like, Kite Man, like you're going to explain in season 3 how he's processed this and he's moved on, because for those who haven't seen the show, spoilers, Kite Man and Poison Ivy are an item for quite a bit, and then she falls for Harley and that becomes her sort of, you know, forever person. And Harley Ivy becomes a thing which, you know, many fans rejoiced about. But then we did have a small fraction who were like, oh, fuck that shit. Like, Kite Man. What about Kite Man? He did nothing wrong. Nothing.
I mean, anyone who can't see the chemistry between Ivy and Harley is just not paying attention.
Perhaps.
I don't know. Team Kite Man.
Yeah. But it's like, we are keeping him in the show. He's moved on. We were like, we're not going to make him like people were like, oh, like he's going to be like a supervillain now. And we're like, no, we've already done like the incel thing with like Dr. Psycho. So Kite Man is like very zen about it. And he's found somebody else.
Do you have any idea when we might be seeing a season 3?
Yeah, I think early 2022. We've written all 10 episodes for HBO Max. So that's after DC Universe. Show migrated over to HBO Max. Mm-hmm. That's where you can see the first 2 seasons now. Season 3 will be on there. But yeah, like I was saying before, like they let us get away with all this shit because like DC Universe was like, it was like the Wild West. They're like, we don't have like a BS&P or a broadcast standards and practices. So if DC was cool with it, we literally had to like, there was one thing like all year that they were like, yeah, no, take it out. It made it all the way to the mix. And I got a call like while we're in the mix, they're like, you can't have the gingerbread man talking about sucking dick under a bridge. And I was like, but it's the gingerbread man. It's not like Aquaman.
Yeah, seriously, who cares?
But they were like, we can't. Yeah. I mean, they did, you know, they police some things about like, oh, this, you're making Aquaman too much of like a bro or whatever, like a doofus. So then we made him into this kind of like princely, you know, like a Disney prince, which they were like fine with for some reason. I think that he comes off even more of a doofus.
Yeah, that plays.
So
I just want to
quickly, because there's a part of me that's like, you guys have worked in live action, you've worked in animation, and animation gives you obviously a freedom that you don't have in live action. I bring that up because this film was originally supposed to be live action.
True.
Perfect Blue was supposed to be live action. That doesn't seem tenable to me. Like it does, I guess. Like there's a world where I guess somebody does that.
Black Swan.
I guess. Yeah. I mean, Black Swan wasn't this is explicit.
This easily could have been live action, I think.
Really?
I think that's, okay. I mean, I think that's the point I'm making.
Okay.
Which is, when you have a story like this, you know, a dark psychological thriller, you are forced to do it live action.
Right.
And, you know, there would have been a certain, I actually can't think of any shots in this entire film that wouldn't be kind of easily translatable to live action. But there is an artistry to this film that you would lose. Now, you may replace it, right? There may be something else in this place. We've certainly seen a lot of movies over the course of our lives.
There's a Paul Verhoeven version of this, for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
You're right.
I mean, I'm thinking just maybe because I'm lame and uncreative, but like this is what Dark City looks like to me, right? Like,
interesting.
Bathed in blues and the kind of
noirish
resting imagery and the dream world logic and all that stuff. Like, I think this is, and we even kind of saw a bad version of this with 13th Floor.
13th Floor, yeah.
Right? Like, the 13th Floor, not the worst movie I've ever seen, but 13th Floor plays with a lot of like similar kind of
doppelgangers,
exactly. You know, reality and losing, you know, kind of losing your sense of self. Now, it's apropos of nothing in 13th Floor, whereas it's, you know, the entire movie here.
Yeah.
But I do think it's live action a bull. And, you know, I tend to, I've said this a lot on the podcast, I like
guardrails. I like rules. I like limitations. It always seems to help me. But I also like freedom of expression. And I like, you know, creators to have the ability to do whatever they want in any medium. And as I said at the beginning of this podcast, it upsets me that, you know, you guys are obviously pushing the medium forward. So I look forward to your award at the Annies in 20 years. Hopefully you're still alive. But what I – who knows? Satoshi died at 46. Who knows? But and pollution wasn't nearly as bad then as it is now. But of course I'll be alive in 20 years, dude. Come on.
10 years ago, pollution was nothing.
Yeah. Especially in Japan. but they just have to watch out for that pollution monster every once
this
in a while.
This is true. It's true.
But or the radiation monster. But I forgot the point I make. The point I make is you guys are doing amazing.
You're talking about them pushing the medium. And
we are. And all I want is a world where you don't have to have jokes to get this stuff made. Like that's what I'm begging for, is a world where you don't have to have jokes.
That's fair.
In order to talk about this stuff, like there is not a funny moment in Perfect Blue, or at least not a moment that is not
no
the opposite of Black Death, dark humor.
Yeah, it's
yeah. I can't.
Yeah. Even the end, which feels kind of like the very, very last line, feels kind of winky, but also in a really haunting way. That almost yeah, it's. So let me just, I'm going to give a brief synopsis.
That felt valedictory to me. Maybe I just took the movie too seriously, but that really felt like I won the movie. I fixed the problem.
See, I saw it as I've lost myself completely.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Let's see. Here we go. Let's talk about
pre-synopsis. A pop singer gives up her career to become an actress, but slowly goes insane when she starts being stalked by an obsessed fan and what seems to be a ghost of her past. Perfect Blue opened in the United States on August 22nd, 1999. It would go on to make roughly $768,000 domestically. It's got 80% on Rotten Tomatoes, 89% from critics. Just a couple quick little reviews. Variety said that the film ultimately disappoints with its just middling tension and underdeveloped scenario. It still holds attention by trying something different for the genre. Slash Film said that the film was deeply violent, both physically and emotionally, writing that this is a film that will leave you with profound psychological scars and the feeling that you want to take a long, long shower. And the San Francisco Chronicle noted that the film's ability to take the thriller, media fascination, psychological insight, and pop culture and stand them on their heads via its knowing adult view of what seems to be a young teenage paradise. And then I'm just going to read a really quick little bit here from, I think that forgive me for pronunciations in this entire episode because I'm going to fuck up a bunch of them, I'm sure. But Nanavi Ganami in Livewire said that through the innovative cinematography manages to create multiple versions of Mima in the anime as Mima's doppelganger, Mima's idol persona, Mima as the actress in the series Double Bind, the personality of Mima presented through the blog and the real Mima, if at all she exists, is lost to herself. In the ending scene of the anime, Mima says, "No, I'm real." She appears to be convincing herself that she is the real Mima. We wait in anticipation for the director of Double Bind series to say cut, and it never comes. In a world where we fashion and wear plentiful identities, how does one identify their true selves? Globalization and the internet in a postmodern society made possible the ability to consume Italian pasta while listening to K-pop in an Indian restaurant. I am writing on a Japanese anime film in English for an Indian media platform. A French philosopher calls this postmodern condition. We cherry pick amongst the several cultures presented to us daily. We experience and wear numerous identities at once, and in a single span of time, almost like a glitch, we're constantly morphing. I think that all of this speaks to a very sort of metatextual film that's speaking on sort of multiple levels of art and media and how we define ourselves amongst all of that. And then obviously takes it one step farther by really sort of immersing you in an actor who doesn't really understand her persona versus her actual personality and what that all means. It's a very, very rich, very complex movie. And then on top of all of that, it's animated. So like it's another medium in and of itself. So when I watched the film, which by the way is like 87 minutes with credits, like it's a short movie. And I kind of had to sit with it for like basically the rest of the day. Like it really kind of, it's hitting you with so much in such a condensed time frame that it really does almost feel like a movie that you need to watch multiple times to really get everything that's going on in it. But I don't. What did you think?
Yeah, I went right into Mortal Kombat.
That's or the right thing to do. I'm not sure.
Talk about cherry picking cultures.
It's a palate cleanser. Hey! Yeah, I did. I definitely. So this was like when I watched it over the weekend before this. This was maybe like the third time that I had seen this movie, and I definitely was just like, "Yep, yeah, still don't understand any of it." So let's put on a little spine ripping.
I don't know that I completely understood it either. But I would also say that, like, I'm still not convinced that I understand every David Lynch film that I've seen, and I've seen them many times over. The movie left me with a visceral emotional experience. And there's several images and moments that are deeply haunting that probably will stay with me for the rest of my life. But Kenny, you look like you wanted
to. I have no idea what happened in this movie until I went. This movie is a very well regarded movie among fans of anime and also like tourists.
Yes.
Like myself, like a tourist in the world of anime, right?
Same here. I am a tourist as well.
When a movie like this, when I watch a movie like this and I'm left befuddled, I tend to go down a YouTube hole and a Google hole and really trying to figure out what people think. Like right now, I'm watching the first season of Twin Peaks, and I have a working theory that David Lynch may have never actually had sex before. And I'm trying to find out what people think about David Lynch and the way he uses sex in his movies. Because I think there's this idea that his movies are kind of like, sexy's not the right word, but kind of wise to sex, like kind of wise to the role sex plays in our society, where I think that they're so alien to anything that has to do with sex and romance, that I mean, I love that about his movies. But I think it's different. My takeaway from his films are, I think, a little different from the conventional wisdom when it comes to sex.
I think there's two types of sex in a David Lynch film. It's either a angelic, beautiful experience, or it is a nightmare hellscape. Like, there's just nothing in between those two things. But
I think it's always kind of a robotic trying, like a robotic means to an end. And I think Eraserhead is entirely about that end. Okay. So I was very affected by Eraserhead, and I think that Eraserhead was the movie where he just put it all out here. He's like, this is what I think. I'm terrified of growing up. I'm terrified of having
parenthood.
Terrified of being a member of society. I'm terrified of, like, and it's so honest that I really like strongly believe, like, David Lynch in some sense does have it all figured out and that he knows exactly who he is, but he has no way how to, you know, comport himself like in real life.
I think that him and Cronenberg either completely understand the human condition or don't understand it at all. Like,
I think that Lynch would never say, I understand the human condition. I think all he would say is, I have a really good sense of who I am and how I fit in.
Yes. I think this film also has a very clear understanding of what it's saying. I'm just not entirely convinced I know what that is.
As I went down the rabbit hole a little bit, a lot of them, you know, all right. So this movie, and I think we should get into the plot because it might help. But this movie is essentially about a girl named Mima, who is a pop idol in what appears to be a B+ J-pop group
called,
right?
Like called Chame.
Chame.
Yeah.
It rolls off the tongue. So he's like a B plus group. They have a following. I mean, like, it's kind of hilarious at their shows. Like, it's a smattering of fans. They're all male.
Yeah, I couldn't tell if that was a function of just like crowds in animation are like impossible to make look great. And so sometimes, like, we run into this problem on the show all the time, where like our supervising director or whatever will be like, please no more than 6 people.
Oh, that's great.
And I just and like, so you watch like Cham or like the girl group, and it's like, yeah, are they like, they're like in a like an outdoor like amphitheater? Like,
I think they're at SeaWorld.
It's very much like a Six Flags or like a SeaWorld. Yeah. And then in some shots it looks like it's just, yeah, like a smattering or just like a, like a paltry attendance. And then in other shots, when they do that kind of like long lensy thing, and it, and all of the audience is essentially just frozen because they're just a background painting, yep. Essentially.
Matte,
it looks
yeah.
kind of packed.
Yeah. Yep.
Like, and there's flashes going off and whatnot. So I can't really tell. And maybe that's just a part of the artistry at work. Like, you don't know what's real and what's not.
It does feel know. Like, it feels like the press is the only thing that they felt was necessary for us to really see. Mm-hmm. It feels like you really have, like, as you said, like a bank of people with cameras or asking questions. And that's and perhaps a crowd behind them. It's to Kenny's point, not a lot of people there.
Kind of critically, this is yes. a I think she's what 19, 20, something like that. She's a young yeah. girl, more
maybe.
Or less. And the whole crowd is men, and they all yes. seem to be like middle-aged men. Correct. It has a very strong brony vibe to me, mm-hmm. right?
Oh, interesting. Yeah,
where like and I think that there's something to that. Sure, you know, I mean, it's weird because Phil and you, when you and I went to Casey Musgraves,
yes,
I expected there to be a lot of young people there, right? Because I thought it was my children and grown-ups.
and your kids wanted to leave like a half hour in.
This was
one of the greatest concerts I've ever been to, by the way.
Because Casey curses a lot, and my daughter Layla hates cursing. And my son Rollins, our twins, loves cursing.
That was so the best like, part. Is like yeah. Rollins loved it. It was like, I want to yeah. stay forever. And Layla was like, I hate the swearing. Why is she swearing like a sailor? I want to go home.
So there are people like me and you, Phil, who like I think we really do like a Casey Musgraves or a Taylor Swift for the right reason.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of people and I'm guessing, Patrick, you deal with a lot of these people. You don't have to, you know, call out your fans, but who like Harley Quinn and Poison Ivy for, you know,
less than good reasons.
They're hot animated babes. Right. And I think that there is some element of that. Now, basically, imagine Harley Quinn and Poison Ivy were real. All right. So that's this movie. And they decided yes. to switch professions. And every aspect of this professional, you know, sojourn is being chronicled in the press. And there's also a stalker who has the best scene in the movie when he's like, I guess he's working the concert maybe, yeah. or maybe he's part of the, I can't really tell his deal. He's a hideous. What do you got, Patrick?
No, I was just thinking like, yeah, I wasn't sure what he was doing there because he's got his, like,
half his
camcorder. Yeah. And it's, I don't know what I guess the rules there are different than here where you can just record concerts.
Yeah.
Well, I guess we all use our phones now to do it. Who's going to stop us? But beforehand, he's basically there with like a professional grade camera sitting on his shoulder.
And he's also terrified because he has this, half his face is covered in his long black hair.
Yeah.
And you don't know what's on that other half.
Don't know what the other eye looks like, but his one eye is very far off to the side of his. It's just very upsetting.
Right. Like the character design, Satoshi Kon's character design, like people's already like have like interesting sort of like, yes. wide set eyes where they're like their pupils are kind of like, some of them. Yeah. But then this guy was like the most extreme. I think
Mima is this like perfect, like symmetrical looking thing.
Yes.
It's Cupid doll almost.
And not to jump all the way to the end, but that is the defining feature that you know that Rumi, her manager, has kind of taken over this.
Because the eyes start to, it's
exactly
very upsetting. Yes.
So this, what was it? Me Mania, whatever.
Yeah, Mr. Me Mania.
Mr. Me Mania is holding her in it. You know, you've done that thing where you're holding your fingers close to your eyes and you can see, oh, look, I can crush you. He's basically
he's
doing that, but holding her.
He's a big Kids in the Hall thing.
He's holding her like she's like a dancing doll in his hand.
Great
and there
shot.
You go, and that's the movie in a nutshell. Is the this idea that once you are on stage or once you are, you know, a public figure, you no longer belong to yourself. You now belong to the public if you're not careful. And I was thinking about you two actually when I was watching this movie. Because I haven't dealt with what you guys have dealt with. I know what Phil has dealt with as the creator of Sleepy Hollow, a show that has a, you know, somewhat ravenous fan base, online fan base. I have no question that you went, you know, from, you know, the frying pan into the fire, Patrick, when you went from, you know,
not in the DC universe to in the DC universe, and how you guys have had to deal with, I'm sure, personal shit online that makes you question, like, why
am I doing this?
Well, yeah, because so this movie is essentially about, well, I think I like laid out the beginning and we'll get more into it, but this movie is essentially about the way when you are a public figure, you start giving over yourself to the public. And then the other thing you do, and I don't know if you got here. I'm not, Phil hasn't gotten here yet. No offense, Phil, but you might have, Patrick. Have you hired a publicist?
No.
If you hire a publicist or even your agent or even your manager start representing you to the world, that's fucking scary too, right? When I hear about the way I'm presented to other people as a writer, it doesn't matter what they say, because in fucking half in 30 seconds, you can't get out what I want you to know about me.
Sure.
Right? So it's this awful shit. Like, he wrote on Entourage and now he writes on a dance show. Holy, that, no, stop. Like, please.
Don't, like, define me by these two credits. Oh, yeah,
God, I know. That, but that's it. That's who I am. And that's very scary. That to a lot of people, that's who I am. And I think that the movie is about that thing that Mima is known for, her, like, you know, her little Cupid doll, dancing pop star, high voiced, not to be taken seriously, public persona is stalking her. And she can never be the person who she wants to be. It's funny because one person that really comes to mind is actually Kaylee Cuoco, who went through that this last year of basically screaming at people, take me seriously.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
It's very hard to go from that to this, but she managed to do it.
Yeah, 12 years on Big Bang Theory.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And I think there's also something to be said too for the, like, Mima having to sort of relinquish her power to a certain degree, this idea of her sort of, like, there's, to me, kind of the fulcrum point, the moment when she truly loses herself is when she allows herself to be raped on film, essentially, because she feels like this is the only way to change the way that people see her. And now they see her in a completely different and a more awful way. And just this idea of sort of having to, I imagine, and I'm not an actor, I don't know this for a fact, but I do think that on a certain level, you know, now more than ever with social media and what have you, the amount you have to let people in now in order for them to feel as though they're invested in you and in your career and in these things, which is completely unhealthy, but is almost a prerequisite now with a lot of these things, projects, where, like, you're not in a Marvel movie if you're not willing to give yourself over to this, you know, to this social media, what have you.
You are required to create a character.
Yeah.
And you are, And this is what this is where I think we failed people, actors and particularly female actors.
For sure.
It shouldn't be let them into your life. Let them meet your kids. Let them know about your hobbies. Take them into your kitchen and
let them see you cook. Let them cook.
Yes. Yeah. Very few people are able to do that for a long time without turning into Gwyneth, who I love, but a lot of people in America hate.
Florence Pugh is the only one who's done it successfully, it seems.
For a week, right? Yeah, Watch out. Like for a week. That's what I'm saying. Like, Gal Gadot tries it and she immediately goes from, beloved to, yeah. So what you have to do is I think, if you're a publicist or someone who is in part in charge of helping these people craft their public personas, is they create a secondary character.
Right.
And the person you should look to is Lady Gaga. And that's why I have so much respect for Lady Gaga, because Lady Gaga is Lady Gaga in public. She's not, Stephanie Germanato, which I think is fairly brilliant. And I think it's why she's been able to weather all of the shit and be able to, maintain her sanity and her artistry and grow as an artist. And she never really feels affected by anything, because it doesn't hurt so much if people are throwing barbs at Lady Gaga. It would hurt a lot more if people were throwing barbs at her.
Yeah. I think the other film that I thought about as I was watching this was Audition.
Have you seen the Takeshi Miike film Audition?
I have not. I know that's a big blind spot.
No, please. It's a phenomenal film. Highly recommend you watching it. And it is another 99 film, which we covered. The reason I bring it up is just because, first of all, there obviously is a cultural connection between, you know, they're both Asian films. And they both sort of deal with how there's this masculinity and femininity issue that exists in that, you know, region of the world that's quite different than it is, I think, in others. But I think that this film really grapples with that idea of power dynamics and what it means to be a woman and how you weaponize your sexuality. It's a very powerful movie in that regard, because I do feel like when she crosses that Rubicon, when Mima allows herself to be sort of used in that way,
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It is the moment that it feels like she snaps. Like, it is the Absolutely, moment when yeah. it feels like it all kind of gets away from her.
Yeah.
I don't know if you wanted to speak to that, but
no, absolutely. I mean, it's the moment where, I mean, it's literally her losing her innocence, because the way that she, you know, so she is this pop idol, she's in Sham, this girl group, and then she announces to everybody that, you know, she is in fact leaving to pursue this acting career. You know, people have sort of mixed feelings about her fan base, and then she, at the sort of behest of her her manager or agent, Mr. Tadakoro, I believe
that's his name, yeah,
ends up taking this gig where she agrees to be raped on camera for this show. And even the way in which she accepts it at that moment in the film, she still has this like innocent sort of, childlike acceptance of this thing. Like, she has no idea what she's about to get into.
Yep.
Absolutely. That is where she starts to break, like you were saying.
It also, just to rewind just a little bit, because it feels like it speaks to what we're, just in terms of story, there's a moment when she gets a fan letter and Mima discovers a website called Mima's Room, which contains public diary entries written from her perspective and which accurately discuss her daily life and thoughts in intimate and exacting detail. This is 1997, mind you, right?
Yeah, it's like a GeoCities.
It's so crazy. Yeah,
she didn't even know what a URL was.
Oh, right. Yeah. She didn't know any of it.
That's the funniest part of the movie, is because like curiosity. Just like,
towards the internet.
The internet.
Yeah.
But now it's like basically this is a fans only thing, right? Like, is that not essentially what degree?
No, because fans only is from is authorized. This is
right. Other shit.
This is like fan fiction.
Right. But I just mean in the sense that, like, it's amazing how technologically ahead of where we are this movie was, is what I'm getting at. Like, this Mima's Room thing feels kind of, and I agree with you, it's not authorized, it's a stalker. I'm not obviously condoning any of that. But just the fact that we are now curating through our social media this perspective into, you know, Florence Pugh is putting a camera and saying, like, this is me cooking. Like, we're giving people this perspective on our lives, which I think we all agree is pretty toxic.
I think the closer analog is she's been hacked. Right?
Right.
She's been hacked. And her identity has been stolen to some extent.
Yeah.
And there isn't a system. Mm-hmm. Or an infrastructure to deal with that. Mm-hmm. Like the beginning of Twitter, like when I impersonated Rob Schneider and stole his identity and faked it. I hacked his life and made it look like he hated grown-ups too, when in fact he was indifferent or probably even liked it because he's such a bootlicker. But
But that's what happened to poor Mima, right?
That's true. You know, it's just like that.
What's interesting, I was thinking about as you were talking, is this is not that dissimilar from the Harley Quinn story, right? The Harley Quinn is, frankly, abused, probably raped. And or I don't know if that is I'm just speculating.
I don't know if that's in text, but I don't know if that is
canon. And is actively trying in your show to change. She's a public figure and trying to change her persona from bad to good, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, in ours initially, it's she's trying to change her persona from sidekick to supervillain, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Or girlfriend like that idea of being a Joker's girlfriend. Yeah.
It was part of the sort of Harley zeitgeist that then like the Birds of Prey. I mean, it's in the title, right?
Yes.
The Emancipation of Harley Quinn. We were all trying to do sort of, you know, the same, like a different take on that kind of theme of this emancipation thing. That totally makes sense. I'm currently stuck on you being Rob Schneider's Mr. Me Mania.
If you listen to our episode with the totally happily
Deuce Bigelow.
No. We did.
We guessed it on an Adam Sandler podcast about grownups.
It's called Totally Happily Madison about grownups. And the thing is, like,
It goes up, whenever, doesn't matter.
But the thing about Deuce Bigelow is it was one of the movies I was least excited to revisit because I really hated it when I saw it as a young
Great
person.
Episode, though.
It, you know what? I gave it a slightly negative review. But I think it's kind of a good movie.
I enjoyed the first one.
I think it's kind of a good movie. And as you know,
he's coming. He's got things to show you.
Keep going.
Here's what. No, this would be great. We'll leave it in. We'll double it. So I.
We can leave it in double. I can't go and show this on their podcast.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Our guest on the podcast, Michaela Dietz, went and got this for me. She met him at, she's a voice actor, and she met him at a convention, and she got it signed to a gigolo from Rob. So I have nothing but love for Rob Schneider.
Oh, my goodness.
So Mima gets this job on Double Bind, and she only has one line, and her line is, "Excuse me, who are you?" Which I mean is perfect.
Did she say excuse me? I thought she was just.
I believe it's excuse me. Who are you? And so she only has, which is it's obviously amazing and speaks to the duality and the and, you know the identity crisis that she's
and her politeness
and her politeness. and then she sees this. So she does her one line, and then she's walking.
That is so film school, right? Like that's like
excuse
like,
me. Who are you? Yeah.
Who are you? It's identity. It's who, I mean, yeah, like this yeah, is yeah. It's so film school 101. But it's great.
It That's, works.
You know, yeah. Another theme. You just lay it out there. It's worth it. It's worth it to go straight.
So then on her way home, she sees herself in a bank of TV screens in the window of an electronics store, which also speaks to Kenny's point of very film school, but totally works, right? This idea of her seeing multiple versions of herself and what does it all mean? And then basically the producers, she has like 5 seconds of screen time. So her agent is able to finagle her a bigger role on the show, but she has to be raped in a strip club.
In the show.
I know a lot. This is a universal global problem. America's not the problem. I'm tired of everyone shitting on America. The Japanese do it too.
Sure. But Rumi is very distressed about this, doesn't want her to do this, says that she shouldn't have to do this.
Yeah. And Rumi, who is an ex pop idol herself. Right?
Correct. Yes. Correct. And her manager, I guess, is what we're led to believe.
She works for Mr. Tadakoro, I think, but she's part of her management team, basically.
Okay. She's like her handler. She's like the day-to-day.
And then Mima obviously says, sure, I'll do it. And there's sort of this moment where you can tell that she feels like she doesn't have a choice, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's this way or this isn't going to happen, which is obviously awful. And I can only unfortunately assume is the way a lot of women feel in this industry, that they have no choice but to weaponize their sexuality in some way or another in order to get people to take notice or in order to get roles in films or whatever the case might be. It's awful. But it feels like Mima feels as though she has no choice but to do that. And obviously it's awful. The sequence is horrific on multiple levels. She's obviously traumatized by it. Halfway through the scene, they stop because they have to like change the lighting and what have you and change the angle. And the actor who's raping her says, "I'm sorry," in the middle of it. Like, "I'm sorry that this is happening." And she's like, "It's okay." Like she's just bubbly and just like, "Everything's fine. Everything's fine," which feels like a defense mechanism, obviously. And she's sort of pushing her way through this whole sequence.
Well, just the way that they shoot it too, for, yes. Like from her perspective, especially where she, it's just like during those sort of moments of silence, she's just like staring up into the lights, like anything to sort of just drown out what is really happening.
Yeah. Whenever it's in her POV, literal POV, where you're just seeing the lights or you're seeing faces or you're seeing sort of this, it's a nightmarish kind of, you know, staccato images of things that are going on around her.
It's very nasty. It's a very nasty kind of scene and a nasty idea of almost like initiation, you know, some kind of initiation into a gang almost that only happens to women. Yeah. But it also kind of, you know, 25 years ago when this movie was made, it wasn't something a lot of people, certainly a lot of men would discuss that a man is responsible for this, just like a man was responsible for Black Swan. But it's very interesting to me that a man is commenting on the misogyny and mistreatment of women in, I would assume, Japanese television film in that culture. And also telling, you know, also has the, you know, kind of privilege and position to tell the story of a young woman who is being mistreated by the culture. And it's interesting on several levels. You know what I mean? Like that is interesting on several levels because there's a paternalism to the whole thing.
For sure.
You know, if you think about it, there's a paternalism to the whole thing, and it's the whole thing is very upsetting. Like I actually am, for whatever reason, I am least affected by the fact that there is a simulated rape on camera. Like the stuff that's happening there does feel like that's not the point of it, right? Because she's not actually being raped. It's more that, kind of what you were saying, Phil, it's more that this is your indoctrination. This is how you have to, like, this is what you have to go through, what the position you have to put yourself in. And that I do find really upsetting. It reminds me of so many actresses that we've seen who have done this successfully, mm-hmm. like Halle Berry, which transformed her career, or unsuccessfully, like Meg Ryan, which kind of killed her career in the cut. Where you've had actresses who've known for one particular thing and someone got it into their head, or maybe they got it into their own head, that this kind of scene is really what people want or need to take them seriously, which never has happened for men. With maybe, I can't think of an example where getting raped or getting, you know, abused on screen like that has transformed an actor from a comedic actor or a sitcom actor to someone who is now taken seriously. So.
Yeah, it's you know, this film is a real indictment of Hollywood to some degree or another. It's an indictment of the music industry, I guess, maybe a little bit. It's interesting to see how on her way home, she sees a reflection of herself in her formal idol outfit, like when she was a pop idol, and she says to a reflection, "Of course I didn't want to do it." And then she sees that all her fish are dead. Like it's just her fish in her apartment are all dead. Like just to really twist the knife here, that like this and she breaks down, and it's really at this point that kind of her paranoia about being stalked, her obsession with her Mima's room thing, her psychosis, it really all kind of starts to shatter into a million pieces. And she starts to really, she starts to have visions of herself. Like it does feel like she kind of really unravels psychologically at this point. And there's this great shot of her. It's this high shot of her when she's in the bathtub. And she's holding her breath and she's sort of like she's face down in the bathtub.
Not sexy at all, but naked.
Not it's sexy, but
very
naked.
Sad. Yeah.
And just the angle of it and the fetal position of it, mm-hmm. just very sort of, it's a really powerful, there's a lot of powerful imagery in this. I mean, this is the thing about animation that I think is worth highlighting for a second, which is, and I'm not telling you anything you don't already know, Patrick, but the detail that goes into an individual frame of animation is really something. And, you know, I often think about, you can buy old cells of like animation cells and you can just see that the exquisite amount of hand-drawn detail that goes into each of those frames. Did you find yourself? I mean, I was really taken with the animationness, but
yeah, absolutely. I mean, and having experienced it now, like a couple of years of doing this, I'm starting to be able to see like, oh, that one's well done. And that's where they like maybe, you know, cut the budget a little bit.
Phoned it in.
And it happens in this film, which is, you know, holistically, a gorgeous looking film. But I mean, that is like, it's what you're saying. Like you can be so precise. You can be so like animators, I think just are inherently kind of OCD.
Sure.
They have that ultimate control. And you are able to be so kind of pedantic about things. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about this movie and maybe a reason for it to be an animated film is that, because of the manipulation of reality, because of like the blurred lines between all of these different, facets of Mima's life, that they are still able to make it look kind of like of a holistic piece, even though she is fractured like that. I was really impressed with just the character design and also just the execution of it. I mean, like, and because Harley is still like, Harley is literally like all the in-betweens is what they call like the, you know, like you have your keyframes and then you have your like tweeners, which are like the artists who are getting a character from A to B. All those are done in Korea by people like in pencils
right,
like
right,
it, is,
right.
It is like and that's another reason why when you get into like the crowd stuff it's mm-hmm. like that person's being paid the exact same amount to do a close-up of a character smiling than they are a crowd of 100 people. So that's why they're like don't do a crowd of 100 people, do six.
You know, it's interesting because I feel like at this point you were talking about the idea of what you can do in animation and what you can do in reality, right? And I think that Mima's mental state at this point is really folding in on itself. It's all starting to feel like what is real, what is the television show, what is real violence, or what did I dream? And this is sort of, I think, a good point to talk about Black Swan just for a second, because it's worth noting, because this has been brought up before, that there are many parallels between this film and Black Swan. He acknowledged, and by he I mean Darren Aronofsky, acknowledged the similarities in a 2010 interview, but he denied that Black Swan was directly influenced by Perfect Blue, although on a Requiem for the Dream commentary or something like that, he mentioned that he had seen Perfect Blue.
He owns the remake rights to Perfect Blue.
Right. So
and he used it to do a scene. I don't know what scene it was. I haven't seen Requiem for a Dream in probably almost 20 years. But
it's a hard movie.
I don't know what scene. Yeah, it's also a movie you never want to watch again. But nope. I don't know what scene it was. But apparently, one scene was kind of a take on something from Perfect Blue.
Really?
So that's how he did that. He owned the remake rights specifically. So he can do the scene that way without getting, you know, in trouble.
And then he made Black Swan, which is also,
And made Black Swan, and he's acting. Look.
I'm not holding it against him. I just wanted to highlight it because it's worth
highlighting. I know. So. Well, I hold it against him a little bit because he denies it. Like, dude. Like, there's nothing wrong with being influenced. We're all influenced.
But I'm just going to read a couple of the similarities because it's worth noting. The main character in this film's name is Mima. In Black Swan, her name is Nina. Mima sings in a, obviously in a girl pop band. Nina dances in a ballet class in hopes of becoming bigger. Before the traumatic events, both Mima and Nina are already shown to be emotionally sensitive characters. I guess that's true. Both characters have psyches altered from these experiences. Both have substantial amounts of blood and violence. The main character, I would say, if I'm being completely honest, and these are all somewhat similar, the main thing for me is... when I think about what we were just talking about in terms of when reality and fiction start to blur together and she starts to have sort of these hallucinatory moments, when Nina in Black Swan starts to see evil versions of herself, the sex scene with Mila Kunis, the you know, faces changing, people's identities changing, all that kind of, like, that felt very much like when we hit the climax of this film and we have Rumi's identity manifested. That felt very sort of like, and I think that Aronofsky does a phenomenal job of making sure that those moments really hit hard in a way that they do in this film. I guess this is a long way of saying that I think that in the right hands, a live action version of this film could very well have worked, because we saw obviously Black Swan worked, but that sort of blurring of reality and those kind of things work in Black Swan because they're done so sparingly. And I think this film, obviously, when Rumi's identity manifests itself and there's that fight that they have in her room and her like eyes and her face starts to contort and change, and like, that to me is when this film is really, really working.
Yeah. It also seems to have this sort of like acceleration where with the, you know, I call it like, you know, when it starts getting like Inception or whatever, Russian doll thing, where she's like constantly like waking up and you realize, oh, she's in the middle of a scene that she's shooting now. And then she wakes up again and it's like, oh no, she's in her apartment with Rumi or whatever. And it starts to just get like quicker and quicker and quicker, which I guess is, you know, pacing to show you just how far down the sort of rabbit hole of insanity she's fallen.
It starts to feel like a nesting doll, like those Russian dolls, right? Yeah, like where it starts to feel like you're inside a doll, inside a doll, inside, like it's all starting to kind of fold in on itself. I agree with you. When that ramp up starts to happen, as we head into sort of the climax of the film, when it's all starting to kind of collide in her head and we're sort of unsure as to like what is real and what is fiction, and that's when the film really spoke to me. I felt like that's when like that metatextuality of itself all just kinds of starts to fold in itself. I think it's tremendous. I mean, basically, I mean, we've essentially hit a lot of the plot. I mean, it gets a little bit convoluted, I think, and I got lost, and I don't know if you guys got lost around that time of like the stalker, the me mania.
Like the second half of the second act a little confusing, and I did kind of lose my way, and it wasn't until the end that it kind of, you know, kind of puzzle pieces kind of felt like they were coming back together.
Yes, I agree.
But I do, I at least for myself, I attributed that to kind of a lack of fluency with the medium, right? Like watching, and this happened to me with Mononoke as well. Like, anime is not like American animation.
No,
you know, it's just it's a different thing, and it is it does feel like a muscle you have to build to understand what they're doing. And you know, I know my kids can't get into Miyazaki. I've tried,
really?
You know, but they're the most American of children. So they're total xenophobes. So
you call them your tiny gaijin.
Yeah, that's right.
But I think that to your point, Kenny, just to piggyback on it for a quick second, I think that there is they are, and by they I mean anime films are speaking in a different language, and I don't mean that literally, I mean that figuratively. Like there is this sort of dreamlike kind of component, and it's the same with Takeshi Miike's films, but also Haruki Murakami's books. There's this dreamlike component to them where it really is, and I don't want to say it's a vibe, but it's kind of a vibe where like you have to kind of roll with it, if that makes sense.
Well, I mean, the other thing is, you know, this, and Patrick, you probably can speak to this, but we watched, at least I watched the subtitled version, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know if, Patrick, you've ever seen this dubbed.
I've never seen this one dubbed.
I don't know if they've done a dubbed version.
Yeah.
But I would have preferred a dubbed version. I find dubbed anime quite charming. And
so do I, actually.
And also, you know, my attention isn't divided. Mm-hmm. I really can focus on the visuals. But I think a second viewing or a third viewing, when you know what's happening, mm-hmm. I think it may be more rewarding. And maybe I should have gone, you know, the extra 87 minutes and given it a shot. But that's what I was talking about, Patrick. If on the second, third, fourth viewing, whatever, you do feel like you immerse yourself in a world in a way that maybe you can't in the first because of, as Director Baum said, the inch and a half barrier that is difficult for some of us Americans to get over.
But I think that, you know, I also found myself thinking about Wong Kar-wai's movies to a certain degree and just that sort of...
It's a similar thing.
That dreamlike sort of thing where mm-hmm. it's like he's not holding your hand through a narrative per se. He's more like it's an immersion in a headspace, if that makes any sense. And you're just along for the ride. And I think that... You know, anime also, I mean, they play it fast and loose, right? I mean, that's Miyazaki's films also do that as well. Like, there are rules, quote unquote, but like, it's really just sort of you're going on this journey. I really believe that, like, that idea of the journey of just sort of is it does feel very mythic. A lot of these things feel, you know, there's that kind of component to it that I just find endlessly fascinating. You know, I watched, have you seen Your Name, the anime film that came out a few years ago?
No, it's on my list. I think
it's tremendous.
Abrams has the rights to maybe do it.
He does. Yeah. But you know who's actually doing it now? Because originally it was going to be, oh my God, Mark Webb was going to do it. Okay. But now it's the guy that did Minari. So I'm very excited to see if that comes to fruition. We'll see
if
it does.
Yeah, that's very cool.
But yeah, it's just I do find that the whole anime thing is such a fascinating but just beautiful and haunting. There's something so unnerving about what they can tap into, and I think this film is probably the most effective in that respect. I'm not sure how you feel about that, but so yeah, I mean, basically the end of the film, essentially, for all just to wrap up the plot of it. Rumi's identity is shown that she is the killer, that she has sort of created this persona that has been, for lack of a better way of putting it, driving Mima insane. They have this visceral fight in her bedroom, which kind of spills out into the streets. And there's this amazing shot of them diving out of the way of that truck that's barreling down the street. Which is just a beautiful shot. And then ultimately, Rumi is put in a psychiatric hospital, and the movie ends with Mima driving off, looking at herself in the rearview mirror and saying, "No, I am the real thing." And then, like, the poppiest music you could ever imagine, just like, it's a lot. I think it's interesting, Kenny, that your takeaway from that last shot was victory. I don't mean that in a negative way.
Oh, I know you don't. That's what I thought. I thought it was valedictory. I really did. I thought she had vanquished her demons.
I mean, that's awesome. I think part of it for me was it felt, I don't want to say that it felt necessarily as though she was completely lost, but it certainly felt winky to me in a way that's not, and I don't, again, mean that in a negative fashion, but it felt aware of itself enough that I was like, is this meant to be a happy ending? How did you interpret the ending, Patrick?
I was probably 5 minutes into Mortal Kombat when I was thinking about it.
Sure.
No, like I literally like the ending, I still am not quite sure at all what really happened. Like, was I was like, Rumi's the killer, but we're saying this is such a dumb question. Like, because she also created the sort of GeoCities thing. She's right. Behind all of it. And we're saying that Mr. Me Mania is just, he's a creep, but he's like, he's just a fan.
I mean, he's still a criminal. My interpretation of the Me Mania guy is that he's a stalker.
Yeah.
Was he ever going to cross that line without Rumi pulling the shit that she did? is hard to say. But I think that that stuff, he felt he needed to, quote unquote, save Mima from right. all of these things that were happening. But in the process, he does cross a line because, like, it seems like he's going to rape her at one point. So, like, there is right. that whole thing. So it's like, I mean, ultimately, they're both bad people. And by that, I mean Rumi and the stalker. But the impression that I got, my takeaway anyway, is that Rumi is the puppet master. She's mm-hmm. the one who's been doing all this bad shit. And that this stalker was essentially a red herring for us to believe that he was the guy that was doing all these things.
Except they worked together. Like,
well, that's the weird part.
It's not really a red herring if they work together, right? He's like a henchman. Yeah. But
yeah,
it's just,
I agree. It's muddy. It's not clear.
Right, because at one point it looks like he is literally going to rape her.
It's a tone poem. It's a tone poem.
It does. It's a tone poem about just awfulness.
I think if you say something's a tone poem, that's just the end, right? You just, okay, sure. It's a tone
yeah.
poem.
It's just it's I don't know. I mean,
I get it. Tone poem. Turned it off. Turned it on. Mortal Kombat.
I mean, listen. I think that. There is a version of this movie that's a little bit longer that feels like it maybe explains some of these things out a little bit more or steps them out. I don't know. It's clear to me that, yes, please.
Oh no, you keep going.
I was just going to say this one last thing, which is it's clear to me that Rumi is the bad guy. We're led to believe that she's the villain that has been quote unquote vanquished at the end of the film. And the stalker just feels like, I don't know. Another bad dude, I guess. But anyway, what were you going
to
say?
Well, no, but to the Rumi thing, like, what do we think are her motivations as the villain? Like, is there an envy sort of thing happening? Is there a protective thing sort of happening? Because, like, you know, she's we have all of these characters getting like their fucking eyes gouged out, you know, all these men yes. that have put Mima in this compromising mm-hmm. position. Literally and figuratively, and then they all end up getting like blind, like their eyes fucking gouged out in elevators and whatnot. like Mr. Shibuya, the writer of Double Bind, that was super creepy.
It was great.
Admittedly love that scene. Yeah. The elevator doors open up. They're playing the Cham song
on
the radio, and then all of a sudden, you know, it's like Die Hard, except.
The way I read the Rumi thing was that it was like Winona Ryder's character in Black Swan if she completely lost it and became violent.
Like, so it is just a psychosis, a general
that's
psychosis.
Kind of, that was the way
that's what it seems like.
Okay, got it. Maybe I called her the Ruminator.
Can you please put her on Harley Quinn?
Ruminator 2?
Ruminator 2, yeah.
Ruminator 2, yeah. Oh, wow. That's fantastic. I mean, listen, I still think about this film 24 hours or so later. I imagine I'll still be thinking about it for a long time to come. And I'm so glad that we got to talk about it with you, Patrick, more than anything.
Me too.
So I want to rate this film. I don't know if you know how we do our ratings on this podcast.
Explain it.
It's very simple for the most part. We rate it from 0 to 99. 0 is the lowest, 99 is the highest. 50% is the threshold of recommending or not recommending. We rate the film before the podcast, and then we rate the film after the podcast to see whether or not our conversation has changed our opinions about a film one way or the other.
Okay.
I'll go first. I had not seen this film in 99 or before the other day. I probably give this film an 82 before the podcast. Coming into it, I thought it was really powerful. It really stuck with me. And this conversation has only bolstered my opinion of it. I have it at an 87 now. Kenny and I talked about Audition a few months ago. I mean, I don't even know when it was. Time is meaningless at this. Who knows?
Was that during the pandemic?
It was during the pandemic.
forever ago.
It literally feels like another life, but
it's impossible.
But I felt similarly. Both these films left me in a similar place in terms of just feeling
terrible about the way we treat women in this world. I think it's just there's no excuse for any of it, especially in this industry that we work in. And I think that this film is an incredibly powerful indictment of all of that. And it's beautifully animated, and I think it's a tremendous film. So that's where I'm at. What about you, Kenny?
First off, Patrick, you have to see Audition.
You would, I think you'd really dig Audition.
It should be the next movie you watch. It is, you know what? It just occurred to me, Phil.
Yeah.
That Audition, I mean, it's crazy. We're doing this the day after the Oscars. The Promising Young Woman won Best Original Screenplay last night. And Audition is the movie that everybody wanted Promising Woman to be.
110%.
You know what I mean? Like, it exists. Even the whole thing. It exists. So watch that movie. That movie's awesome. Promising Woman, you know, people have their feelings.
A divisive film.
This movie, I gave it an 80 before this podcast. And I'm going to leave it at an 80. I don't feel like my... I think it's a really interesting film to talk about. I think it's a really good film. I think my esteem for it will grow if I watch it again. But
the dubbed version,
which as we were podcasting, I checked to see it does exist.
Yeah.
I'll come back to you. I'll report back if I watch Perfect Blue again. But very cool film. Very happy it exists. Very upset that we don't do things like this here. I think there's an entire universe of cinema, but then English language cinema created by English speakers that we're missing out on, and it's pathetic. Go ahead, Patrick. Totally.
Patrick, what do you think?
Well, before I did the podcast, I didn't rate the film because I didn't know about the rating system. After the podcast, I'm going to give it an 89.
Nice. Awesome.
Which is high praise.
Yeah.
That's like a solid A.
Yeah. That's a great rating.
I read a quote from Satoshi Kon where he said, you know, a movie like Mulholland Drive is my favorite type of movie because you figured out about 80% of it, and the other 20% you're probably never going to figure out again. And absolutely, this falls in that category for me. You know, it falls in those categories of need Mortal Kombat as a palate cleanser, which is about an 89.
I also just want to say too that, you know, I saw Totoro. I saw on the big screen whatever that was a year or two ago, whenever it was. And then I also saw Your Name on the big screen. This is a long way of saying that these anime films on a big screen are so breathtaking to look at, to see that level of animation, which, as we all know, very little is not as much as hand drawn as it used to be. A lot of it is computer generated and what have you. But to see that stuff on the big screen is absolutely exquisite and just really, really powerful stuff. But
And Paprika, his last film,
final film,
say, his final film was like from about 2006. I want to say that's one absolutely worth seeing on a big screen. Talk about like fucking crowd scenes in animation and doing that right.
Yep.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah, the one that I was bummed I missed on, I really wanted to see Spirited Away on the big screen because that movie, I think, is just an absolute masterpiece on so many levels and just exquisite to look at.
I have seen parts of this before.
Oh.
Because Madonna, on her tour, would play the particularly racy scenes on a large screen. Mm-hmm. I saw Madonna at Madison Square Garden with my sister and parents.
When?
This was like in 2002.
Okay, cool.
So with my sister and parents, these images are happening on the screen, which, you know, we didn't mention that there is like full frontal animated nudity in this. That's what I'm talking about. That's what Madonna selected to show me and my parents as we watched her perform.
Specifically, you and your parents, I believe.
Can I remember that? That was the tour where she... This one's for Kenny and the Nightbars! That's how she speaks, too. Because She was in her muscly phase when she learned how to play guitar. So everything goes,
oh my God.
Here's some baby!
Here's a naked drawn woman for you. The only song she did from like her catalog were Isla Bonita and like Holiday. I'm like, great, wow. You know, whatever.
Sure. But
from the Immaculate Collection.
Sure, sure.
Yes,
they're both great songs.
Hey, they wouldn't have been my choices, but at least I could sing along to something. Everything else is new shit, like new shit. Like this is post Ray of Light. This might have been post Music. Like this is like some of the shit that like this is like, you know, this is like.
I couldn't name a song of hers other than the ABBA, the one that she samples ABBA.
After Music,
Hung Up. I think.
Don't think I. Oh, Hung Up's a good song.
Hung Up's a great song.
And she also did the song with Justin Timberlake, which is an amazing song. Like 6 Seconds,
yep,
I think it's called.
Yep. This is all before. Is this all before Die Another Day, I think?
No, Die Another Day. Oh, it was like 2001.
I don't know. All right, anyway, but it doesn't matter.
Great concert. Very weird to see with your parents. Definitely the weirdest experience.
But it's also, I don't think it should surprise any of us that she's seen Perfect Blue. And the Perfect Blue speaks to her that she wants to show us the most jarring images from Perfect Blue.
Yes. Yeah. Like a good double feature of like Perfect Blue and then like the Britney Spears FX documentary.
Sure. She's
like,
and then Truth or Dare.
Yeah. Swept away.
Yeah. So next week, I don't know if you've seen this film, Patrick. I don't know if are you an Errol Morris fan? Have you ever seen any of Errol Morris's documentaries?
Yeah, sure. The Thin Blue Line.
We're doing Mr. Death tomorrow. I don't know if you've seen Mr. Death, but it is
hard to find. Good flick, though.
Hard to find film. Very good movie. We have Simon Ennis on, a filmmaker and a good friend of mine from back home who came on to talk about it with us. And it's all about, what would you say it's all about, Kenny? Denying the Holocaust? What is truth?
I don't want to give away the twist, but yeah, it's all about denying the Holocaust. It's about a guy. It's about a guy who basically is the number one creator of or designer of devices in America.
Yeah.
Who then gets called upon by some Holocaust deniers. Mm-hmm. To attempt to prove that Auschwitz was not actually a place where they gassed Jews. So he starts to buy into it
essentially, and it is a very interesting
because of quote unquote science, and I put quote unquote in there. Like the movie to me, it's a brilliant, interesting documentary, and he's a really fascinating character because he's almost been given this air of expertise. Because nobody is in the field. Like nobody wants to be the engineer who's good at killing people. So he's the best, but he's not even an engineer.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's really interesting, really, really interesting movie.
It's obviously
an amazing documentarian who like is able to pick up every rock and find the most unique subjects. So.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, I'm sure that you've seen a couple of his films, Patrick, but like, I don't know where Errol Morris finds these people, but like, not only are they just
rocks,
fascinating
under rocks,
not only are they fascinating people, but like their look is so fascinating. This guy is so fascinating to look at.
The worst thing about him is like for the first half an hour of the movie, you're like, this guy's amazing.
Wait a second, am I on board with this guy?
I didn't know anything going into it. It wasn't even a question I was on board with it. I didn't know anything going into the movie. I didn't know the Holocaust and our stuff, so it was a twist for me. So basically, I'm like, he says at some point that he drinks 40 cups of coffee a day, and I'm like, oh my God, you're my hero.
It's a great movie. It's a great episode, and check it out next week. But thank you so much, Patrick, for coming on and talking with us about this. We really appreciate it.
And thank you, Kenny and Phil.
Great.
Please. And just as another reminder, please check out Harley Quinn. It's on HBO Max right now. It's without a doubt the best animated show on TV.
If you're
right
listening
now, it's
to
fantastic.
This podcast, you probably do.
It's great.
You know, we have a lot of close-up, just people with great taste.
It's got probably one of the. I mean, it definitely has the best voice cast on TV right now. It's tremendous. It's a great show.
Half man, half kite.
Yeah,
maybe
you got a kite man. I mean, it's the only show with a kite man on TV right now. That's for sure. Yeah. I think right.
It's great. It's really great. I spend the only free time I have watching Harley Quinn and Rick and Morty. So that's me.
I'll know we've made it when Madonna's using clips from Harley Quinn in her next tour.
Dude, she might. Could happen.
She's not the pop star I think would do it, but there are several who I think would. Yeah. Yes. Like Miley's probably already done it, just didn't tell you.
I'm surprised Miley hasn't been on your show as a voice actor, quite frankly, if I'm being honest. But that's
she's so cool.
She's got a great voice.
She does have a great voice. We haven't gone after her yet. We got some music this year in season 3. We got some songs.
Nice.
We got a lot of songs. I'm excited about that. And our cast can sing too. Like Sanaa Lathan is Catwoman. She can sing. Diedrich Bader, Batman. He can sing.
He can sing.
He does.
That's so cool. It's such a cool
if you want to be a proper improv actor, you should be able to sing.
Yeah,
so
agreed.
There you go.
His great I would imagine a great deep baritone.
Mm. Silky.
Let's
get out of here.
All right. Thank you so much, Patrick.
All right, Patrick.
Thank you, guys.
One last thing. Please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hanna, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Also, please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits. We're also on Twitter at podcastlikeits. We're also on Instagram at podcastlikeits. Thank you to Ernie and Will for producing our episode, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our artwork and theme songs, and most of all, thank you all for listening. 1999, podcast like it.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.